This is episode number 107 with data scientist at Utopus Insights, Gabor Shoyemoshi.
Welcome to the Super Data Science Podcast. My name is Kirill Eremenko, data science coach and lifestyle entrepreneur. And each week we bring you inspiring people and ideas to help you build your successful career in data science. Thanks for being here today, and now let's make the complex simple.
Welcome everybody to the Super Data Science Podcast. Super pumped to have you on board, and today I've got a special guest, a friend whom Adlan and I met during our European road trip, Gabor. Gabor is from Budapest, Hungary, and that was our, I think it was third stop during our road trip. It was very exciting to meet everybody there, and Gabor's story was especially resonated with me because of his, you know, of his dreams and passions and how he works to accomplish them, how he works towards them. And I'm very excited to hear that since the road trip, which was a couple of months ago, Gabor has made progression in his career. He's got a new job and he's actually working towards his goals, as you'll see from this podcast. So Gabor is a very interesting person, very passionate about data scientist. We'll talk about three of the roles that he's had to date in the space of data science. We'll talk about things like text analytics, survival analysis, and jumping into an industry completely foreign to him, how switching from one industry to another, how you're able to switch from one industry to another, being a data scientist and transferring those data science skills, and what is the experience of that, what he's going through as he's moving to something completely different. And as you'll hear from the podcast, it's very, very exciting, the industry that he's just jumped into. He's working with solar and wind turbine energy. Who would have thought they also need data scientists there? So quite a lot of interesting things we talked about here. But probably the main thing I'd like you to focus on is the path, the way that Gabor has intentionally chosen the roles in his data science career and how he's working towards his dreams. And so I can't wait for you to hear his story, and let's get started. And without further ado, I bring to you Gabor Shoyemoshi, who is a data scientist at Utopus Insights. Welcome everybody to the Super Data Science Podcast. Today I've got a very exciting guest, a friend of mine from Hungary, from Budapest, Hungary, Gabor Shoyemoshi. How are you going, Gabor?
Thank you very much, Kirill. I'm really excited to be here, actually.
Awesome. That's so cool to hear you. Can you remind us how we met? Where did we meet? So that the new listeners can get a bit acquainted with our story.
Yeah. So I known you before because I took several of your classes on Udemy. Mm-hmm. But then once I got an email that Kirill is coming to Hungary, Budapest, so I took the opportunity and we met there, actually. It was a quite nice dinner, and we went on a few bar trip, let's say.
Yeah.
It was quite interesting, and
yeah,
we had a lot of good talks at that time.
Yeah, exactly. It was fun. It was during the road trip, so a lot of you listening to this podcast might know that Adlan and I did a road trip this summer through Europe. One of our stops was Budapest, Hungary. And yeah, so we met quite a few of our students there. It was interesting talking because I think you or someone else was saying that you were very surprised that we came to Budapest. Like it was, we started with Italy, then we went to Munich. And then the next email that came out was like, we're going to Budapest. Were you a bit surprised at that, or were you expecting it?
Yeah, actually, I didn't expect it. I was checking the mails that you were doing this Europe trip, and I didn't think that you were going to come to Budapest, but I thought, okay, maybe Prague or some other bigger cities. But yeah, I think you had a good time here also.
Yeah, it was good, and thanks a lot for showing us around. Very interesting city. So if somebody hasn't been to Budapest, we liked it quite a bit. Adlan really fell in love with the city. It's got this big, massive river. What's the river called again?
It's the Danube.
The Danube, the river. It's a big river. It goes through a lot of countries in Europe. And and but in Budapest, it's like really wide, and you've got two parts of the city. You've got Buda and Pest. Yeah, I think the story goes that there were two separate cities that were growing on both sides of the river, and then at some point they just decided to become one city. Is that right?
Yeah, it's kind of like a short summary how it got together.
Yeah, and then Gabor and some other students showed us around the city, and it's got quite a lot of monuments, and we even saw the statue to Gabriel, and that's where you told me that your name, Gabor, is a derivative of Gabriel. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, that was very interesting to learn. Never knew that before. Anyway, so we're here to talk about data science and your journey into the space of data science. So tell us a bit about what you do. You just told me just before the podcast you got a new job. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Yeah, actually, I've recently changed my job from one company to another. And now I'm working as a contractor data scientist for an exciting new energy analytics company called Utopus Insights. As I told you, it's actually a spin-off from IBM Research, and it's headquartered in New York, but I work from Budapest, Hungary. So it's kind of a remote job.
That's so cool. So wait, let's just rewind a bit. Where did you work before Utopus Insights?
Yeah, actually, I was also working as a data scientist at Xept. Well, I will go into details with that also because it was really interesting. So so that's my two first data science jobs.
Okay.
And before that, I was a data analyst, but it was something a bit different. But now I'm really happy to be here because it's really cool. And well, actually, you know, basically I'm working from home most of the time, which has its benefits, of course, and disadvantages as well, since I have a lot of time dealing with things around the house or waking up a bit later or doing workout in the morning.
Getting distracted.
yeah, that's true. But, you know, on the other hand, of course, it can be a bit boring sometimes because I have regular Skype meetings with the others in the States. Yeah. And here we have a team in Budapest with whom I regularly meet. Actually, it's quite nice.
Okay. And so you said it's a contract. So when you were working with Xept, was it also a contract or was it a full-time job?
No, that was a full-time job. So it's also like kind of full-time, but I'm working through an HR company.
Uh-huh. So you traded in a full-time secure job for a contract, is that right?
Yeah, kind of. It's like that. But
interesting.
But of course, it's really interesting and it's really exciting for me to work with this now because actually I really wanted to do something with the energy industry to how to help the future, like doing something with renewables and these things. It's really interesting.
I can totally imagine, but like the whole concept is very interesting because a lot of people wouldn't do that. They would think, you know, this is a full-time job versus a contract. The contract can expire versus a full-time job. I'm very secure in what I'm doing. So was it a hard decision to make to give up that security of your job, of your income, and to go for something more exciting, but something that's a contract that can, you know, can end and cannot be might not be renewed?
Yeah, well, actually, you know, when I was thinking about it, I didn't want to change jobs at the time.
Yeah.
But it was quite an opportunity for me because I have a friend who said that they have an opening in the Budapest office, and I really wanted to do something with this renewable energy data science stuff. And for this, you know, I kind of traded my like secure things for a contract, but it was worth it. I think, you know, it's like, of course, it's a contract, but I wouldn't change if it's not for more money or like these things, you know, and it's really exciting.
Yep. Yeah, no, that's really cool and very inspiring to hear as well because, you know, like after our chat in Budapest, like I probably should mention this to the listeners, like this was one of my most inspiring conversations that I had on the road trip because like you, when we were talking, you said that look, there's certain dreams that I have and goals, and I want to, you know, like ideally I'd love to live. Do you remember that conversation about Spain?
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. What did you say? Like, what is that? Tell us about your dream. What is your dream in relation to Spain?
Yeah. Well, actually, you know, I lived in Spain because I did my Erasmus semester mm-hmm. in Barcelona, mm-hmm. and I really love the spirit of the city, and it's just extremely cool.
Yeah.
And you know, I've always wanted to go back there since I was there for this one semester, and my dream was to just, you know, find a job there, like, with this, I don't know, like hotness and everything that, you know, it's like here I know everything in Hungary, yeah. in Budapest,
and, yeah.
and it's just not that exciting, and I wanted something more. Of course, I've always wanted more, but you know, with this one now, I think it's kind of great now.
Yeah, and like you, and you like the do you like the Spanish language?
Yeah, of course. I actually learned Spanish, so. Mm-hmm. I know a couple of things. I'm not perfect, but I know the basics, and I really like it. You know, I learned Catalan also because of Barcelona.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's really cool. All right. Anyway, so what are the point I was going to what I was going to say is that Gabor's dream is like to live in Spain and work in Spain and so on. And one of the things that we discussed during our catch up was. That like you remember you said you were a bit disappointed that unfortunately like the economy in Spain isn't the best right now and it might be hard to find a job and so on, and I mentioned that like you don't really have to find a job in Spain, you can live in Spain but you can work or like as a freelancer through Upwork or through other websites, and it's very exciting to hear that now you have a remote job and you just got a remote job where you're working from home, and like in my view, it's like a step towards that goal, and it's very inspiring to hear that you're on that journey already.
Yeah, thank you very much. Well, actually, it's really exciting, and I also feel like it's kind of an improvement since we last talked.
Awesome. Okay, so you just moved from Accept to Utopus Insights. Tell us a bit about the work that you do. Like, in what space of data science are you at the moment?
Okay, well. So actually, I'm kind of a data scientist / analytics engineer. Mm-hmm. I'm involved in multiple projects that focus on like forecasting the performance of renewable energy farms, like solar farms, wind farms, turbines, and so on. Mm-hmm. So, well, that's what I currently do. It involves a lot of statistical learning methods and a lot of mathematics also and a lot of engineering. Mm-hmm. I actually don't have an electrical engineering industry background, but with these people here, they help, and I kind of bring the data science knowledge also. So it's kind of cool.
Okay.
I really like it.
Okay, that's pretty awesome. And so what does an analytics engineer do? I've never heard of that profession before.
Yeah, well, it's kind of a data scientist stuff also. Well, it's just about building the analytics platform also, like working with databases and like... Uh-huh. How to extract the data, how to put it into the analytics platforms and, uh-huh. and these things also. And behind also, I know the science stuff. So that's what it is. It's just how they call us.
Okay. All right. So like it's a mix of a data scientist, a database architect, that type? Like
Yeah, kind of that. Yeah. But actually we are working with a lot of software developers who actually do this. Back-end stuff, the deep back-end, you know, but of course I have to be involved in these things. And
mm-hmm. Interesting. So you work with solar and you said wind turbines. What other forms of energy? Is it solar?
Yeah, it's solar and wind.
Mm-hmm. Solar and wind. So just out of curiosity, which one is the most efficient right now? Like the ones that you work with, not the world standards or the leading world ones. The ones that you work with, what do you find more efficient, solar or wind?
Well, actually, I'm not quite into that one yet.
Oh, okay.
So I don't have too much insight on which one is better, but probably in a few months I could give some insights on this also.
Okay, gotcha. All right, cool. All right, and so when you say you do analytics for solar and wind, what exactly do you do? Do you like calculate how much is consumed, or do you calculate how much, you know, the maintenance requirements? What part of that analytics are you involved in?
Yeah, well, now I'm actually like I'm involved in validating machine learning models like forecasts and choosing the right metrics for evaluation, like communicating with the other analysts and engineers, software developers on what and how to improve. So this kind of stuff, of course, it involves a lot of research.
So what are you forecasting?
Well, we are forecasting the like performance, the power of the wind turbines, you know, like wind and solar panels, like how much power they give.
So how much energy you will have in the future.
Yeah.
That's very interesting because like we all use energy, we all use electricity, and we all hear about like solar and wind and so on, but I've never actually spoken to someone in this space, and it's good to have an example that even in these industries, you still need data science. You still need data scientists. I was thinking originally maybe there's very historical types of roles and types of calculations like scientists or engineers that are performing these estimates and forecasts. But nevertheless, you are a data scientist who's working in this space, and this is something new for you, right? When you were working at Accept, were you doing the same thing, or was your role something related to something different?
Well, it was a bit different, but at that I was working with like predictive algorithms, predictive maintenance analytics, which is kind of involved because here we are also planning to do something like that. But as you mentioned, that there are like. You thought that it was scientists and these kind of people who are doing these forecasts and these things. Well, you know, we have meteorologists in the team also, and who is doing the weather forecast. And we have a lot of electrical engineers, and they have like a vast background of science of the field.
Really. Okay. And so in Accept, were you working with energy as well or something else?
No, actually there I was working on a project which was called like predictive maintenance for heavy machines. It was kind of interesting. We were doing survival analysis there, predictive algorithms through like R server. I was creating like these web APIs with R, which is actually it was really cool. I really liked it.
All right, awesome. We'll get to that in a second. I just wanted to again like stress for those listening that before, when did you start at Utopus? Was this like a few months ago?
Yeah, it was a few months ago.
Okay, so literally a few months ago, Gabor, I don't know, how much knowledge did you have about solar and wind energy and their, you know, like consumption and stuff like that? Were you an expert in that field?
Not too much.
Not too much.
So, yeah. So, you know, if you're really interested in something, just make researches, and that's what I did before applying for these things.
Yeah, and that's why it's so exciting, because like 2 months ago or so, you had no knowledge of that industry, or very little knowledge about what solar turbines, how they work, what their energy flow is, efficiency, and so on. And the same thing for, solar farms and solar panels, and then wind turbines, and same thing. But you had was like your data science skills, your machine learning skills, and so on. And you brought that, and now you like 2 months later, you're in a completely new field, something very interesting. And I think it's a very inspiring example for those listening that if you're interested in something even as complex as solar energy, you can just go and become a data scientist there. If you're interested in wind turbines, you can go and become a data scientist there. Like, regardless of your background, like, what I'm getting to is that somebody might think that you have to be an expert in solar to even be considered for a role in solar. No, you don't. Like Gabor here, as he's showing by example, you just have to be a data scientist or like be confident in your skills, do some research, and then go there. And that's I think it's a good testament as well to the transferability of data science skills that you can go from one industry to another very quickly. Like in your case, from heavy machinery, which doesn't have that much to do with solar in the first place, and you can just move to solar energy or wind turbines or whatever. And so, like basically, guys, dream big, and wherever you want to work, whatever is your passion, you will be able to get in there quite quickly.
Yeah, that's true. You summed it up really good. And actually, the funny thing that I will go into in a bit, is that before doing data science for heavy machinery, I was doing text analytics.
Text analytics. That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So there you go. That's a jump from, and that's when you were a data analyst. Where was, what was the company called there?
Yeah, it was Sykes.
Sykes. So yeah. before Accenture, you're at Sykes and you're, it's text analytics. That's so cool. So it's such a big change from text analytics to working heavy machinery to now working in the space of solar and stuff like that. You touched on a very interesting topic. I think we should expand on that more because I haven't had anybody on the podcast talk about it yet. Survival analysis. I've heard a little bit about it. I've read a bit about survival analysis. Could you give us an overview what it's all about and how does it work?
Yeah. So actually, I wanted to talk about it, of course, because it's really interesting. And you know, did you know that it's actually one of the oldest statistical disciplines? Like it has roots in demography and actuarial science, like economics.
Yeah.
And it dates back to the 17th century.
That's so cool.
I did a lot of research on it, and because it's so interesting, you know. And it, well, in the beginning, it was most importantly used in demographical analysis, like vital statistics that deals with statistics on like birth, deaths, marriages, divorces, and these kind of things. And since then, of course, it became widely used in other fields as well, like economics, failure analysis, and like mechanical systems, like what I did for heavy machines. And well, it's actually about analyzing data where your outcome variable is the time until an event, you know? For example, it can be death or marriage or failure or something. So it's basically
So in marriage, survival is how long you can survive until you get married. That's so funny. It puts marriage in a bad light, but okay, gotcha. It's just a term. I guess it comes from where it originated. It's originated with like how long people live, like before, you know, or before they get sick or before they die or something like that.
Yeah, that's it about. And it's, you know, if you think about it, that the outcome is kind of like a continuous variable. Well, it's not continuous because it's time, and it's actually a generalized form of like a high dimensional regression analysis, and it's really interesting, you know. It's really cool, and this is the one thing that, and a good example that we were talking about like a few minutes before, like you can just apply it on anything, you know.
When you say the outcome is not continuous, what do you mean? What do you mean by that? I mean, like, well, it's time, right? It can be...
Yeah. It's kind of like continuous. So, like, for example, if you want, I can talk a bit more about it, of course, like...
However you want to structure this. Like, you're the expert. Let's just tell us about survival analysis. What do we need to know? What's the most important fun stuff?
Okay, well, actually, what I did there, it's also like this time that you are measuring, or time to event, or the survival time. It can be measured in whatever you want, so in days, weeks, years. So it's a continuous variable, let's say. So for example, if the event of interest is like a failure, then the survival time can be the time in days or hours or even years until, for example, a machine develops a failure, let's say. Yeah, it has a lot of interesting terms also, like censored and uncensored observations. And like, for example, there are two kinds of like subsets of the data where what you can deal with, like the censored and the uncensored one. In some of them, there is the, like, for example, if the event hasn't happened, so you don't have any observation of the event with that kind of machines, and then it becomes hard to define the survival time at the end.
Okay, and how do you go about it then?
Yeah, actually, there I incorporated some averages and other statistics where you don't have the exact time, but yeah. I can't talk about too much of these things.
Okay. But let's say in real life, would you use survival analysis if you're testing some sort of medicine? You have a population of people and they're or let's say not even people, you have like this group of mice, you want to see if this medicine helps them live longer. So is that an example when you would use survival analysis?
Yes. Okay. Actually, if you have a good number of observations, of course. And actually in biostatistics, it's really, really commonly used.
Uh-huh. All right. And so what makes survival analysis stand out? Like, is it just the fact that we're counting backwards? We're looking at, how much time until these mice start, unfortunately dying? Or is it something else? Like, is there a certain reason why survival analysis is so interesting and has its own kind of domain?
Yeah, so actually, unlike ordinary regression models, like here our dependent variable in survival analysis is composed of two parts. One is the time to the event of interest, and the other is the event status, which records if the event of interest occurred or not. So from this, you can define the censored and uncensored observations, of course. And for example, here you can estimate two functions that are dependent on time, mm-hmm. the survival function and the hazard function. Mm-hmm. And well, actually these two functions are the key concepts in survival analysis describing the distribution of event times. So for example, the survival function, it gives for every time the probability of surviving or actually not surviving or not experiencing the event up to that time. Mm-hmm. So actually it's starting at one, it's a positive valued monotone decreasing function. So mm-hmm. when you are going through time, of course, you will get a score at every timestamp, let's say. And as you are going forward in time, your probability score that you will survive will decrease. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's starting at one. And it's a positive valued monotone decreasing function. And on the other hand, the hazard function gives the kind of the potential that the event will occur per time unit. And given that the individual has survived up to that specific time. So mm-hmm. actually it's part of the survival function also. So it can change over time. For example, it's increasing as components age. So is the difference. It's actually the kind of the opposite. So the survival function is going decreasingly and the hazard function is going upwards.
But because they're not like one is not the complement of the other. It's just that it's normal that the older a person is or a machine is, the more likely that something will go wrong.
Yeah, it just gives you a hazard score, but it's not the one minus the survival function.
Okay, gotcha. So just to recap, so you got the survival function, which gives you a score, and basically, like, give us an example with the machine, right? So how would that work? How would you apply that score with in the case of heavy machinery?
Okay, so for example, if you have an engine that you start the engine, and if it's a brand new engine, that of course at zero time, your survival score will be one mm-hmm. because you just started the engine and you probably think that it's going to survive.
Yeah, like, 100%. Yeah.
And as you're going through time, you're going forward in time, this score will just decrease. And of course, it will decrease based on the features that you are using, based on the correlation between those features and how they correlate with the output, of course, with the time and the status and, mm-hmm. and everything that's there.
Mm-hmm. And so, for example, if your survival function gives you, I don't know, like a value of 0.6, 30 days after you started using the engine, that what that means there's a 60% chance that it survives. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so, and that's like for one engine, you can think of it as probability of survival. But in terms of like, let's say if you have 1,000 flowers, right? And then if on day 30, they have a 60% score or a 0.6 score from the survival function, you can say that out of those 1,000 flowers, only 600 will survive up to day 30.
Yeah, you can put it that way also.
Okay, cool. And so, and then with the hazard function, how does that? What is that? How does it? How does it work?
Yeah, actually, with that you will get a hazard score.
Yeah.
Which is, well, that score is included in the survival function, of course.
Mm-hmm.
It will be, so it's an increasing function on like, not like the survival function.
Okay.
So then you will get a hazard score. So for example, it's almost like minus the one minus the survival function, but it's it just incorporates the survival function incorporates the hazard function inside it.
Okay, makes sense. So like at the start you have an engine, it's brand new, everything's okay, so the hazard would be like very low. But then if you go forward and go further and like, you know, 100 days later you have that same engine, your hazard score would be higher, meaning that there's a higher chance that it will break down.
Yes, yes, true. And of course these scores are assigned based on the historical data that you are using for some, that's it, and the features that you
Gotcha. Oh, I see now. So the hazard function will take into account that the, let's say, the engine won't survive for another like 1 day or for another 2 days. Is that right?
Yes, yes, it's true.
So it depends on the time that you want to evaluate. Like it's already lived, it's already survived like 100 days. Now you want to see, will the engine survive another 5 days? Then you'll have one hazard score. But if you want to see, will the engine survive another 50 days, then you'll have a worse hazard score, which will, because it's less likely to survive longer.
Yep.
Okay, true. That's pretty cool. So there's a whole mathematical apparatus behind this survival theory. And I think that's why I found it very interesting in the first place. That
it's
very well defined and it can be applied to many different problems in life, and like you say, machinery and other areas as well.
Yeah, that's true. I'm glad you like it also. It's really interesting actually, and fascinating how it can be applied for anything.
Yeah, awesome. Okay, well, guys, if you found this quick overview of survival analysis interesting, have a look into it. I think it's a pretty cool area of data science, which is good to at least know about. Okay, so you said you did survival analysis at your previous job. Now you're working with solar and wind. But before that, you mentioned text analytics. So what were you doing in the space of text analytics?
Yeah, well, actually, I got that job because of my thesis work. Because, you know, during the university, my thesis was like based on social media analytics. And it was kind of a one-year-old laboratory work. Actually, I broadened my knowledge in like natural language processing, like text mining, classifying the sentiment and emotions of reviews from social networking sites like Yelp, Foursquare, and Twitter also. I really enjoyed doing it. You know, I did some parts of my work in Python, like SPSS, RapidMiner, but the heavy part, the computation and running the algorithms, was done in R. Because I don't know, I just find it like quite handy doing this in R, and I got the job because of this project actually, and I started working as a social media data analyst, where I had to rely on my knowledge on text analysis and keyword based information extraction and so on, and I was analyzing the sentiment of posts, comments, messages, forum questions for tech companies. If they were positive or negative mentions, or if they were about a specific product like hardware or software related issue, etc. Well, it was quite interesting because I still believe that businesses really can make a difference and improve themselves by gaining knowledge on their customers from social media, you know, because everybody's posting and texting a lot of things. And if you analyze it well, you can really improve your business. And of course, you know what the hardest part was? Like, it was getting harder and harder when we extended the regions, and we were not just analyzing the English content, but when you had European languages like Hungarian, Polish, Greek, and so on. That's the heavy part, you know. I've been actually there. I've been looking into some of the like best sentiment analytics tools, but I haven't found the best, you know, that has a great accuracy. So in this case, you you will need the help of manual categorization by language professionals or someone who can do it for you, you know? Mm-hmm. And yeah, actually now I think back that I really like that job. I really like text analytics because maybe for all data scientists is one of the most common thing to like analyzing text. I really liked it, you know, and there actually I became a senior data analyst very quick as they actually saw that I know what I'm doing and they trusted my insights. And during that 2 years of work, I kind of helped setting up a team of like multilingual international data analysts, like 5-10 people. It was really interesting.
That's so cool. So what tool did you use for that? Was it was it Python or something else?
Yeah, actually first, in some parts I was using R, some parts I was using Visual Basic and Excel, but the most part of it was done by Salesforce has quite a good marketing tool for this sentiment analysis and like kind of like web scraping. It's called Radiant 6. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if they still call it like that. At that time, it was Radiant 6 by Salesforce. It's a very powerful tool that you can just collect a lot of things from blogs, technical forums. You can just give the URLs and so on, and you can just collect any kind of information by, like, you know, it also relies on this Boolean keyword extraction, where you can just define what keywords do you want to use with and or ors. Mm-hmm. And it was really cool, actually, and you can just download a lot of things. It can be connected even to Facebook business pages or Twitter business pages with Google Plus, everything, and you can even see the inbox messages. You can just analyze the inbox messages also. It's really cool if you are working like a... Yeah, we were doing like customer service job. Mm-hmm. Like, I wasn't involved in answering the customers, but I was the one like analyzing and gathering the insights for our clients.
All right, so can you walk us through this? Once, let's say, you use this tool that you mentioned or some other tool and you connect it, and what happens? It downloads, it goes to the web page, it finds a comment, it downloads it into a file or into a database, and then what? It restructures it, so because all comments have different structure. Can you walk us through the process from like start to finish, please?
Yeah, actually, so you can define what kind of platforms do you want to make your search on.
Yeah.
And then you can define the keywords that you want to look for. For example, if you are looking for Apple, you can just put Apple and plus, you can put like iPhone, and plus, if you are analyzing the different models, you can just put like 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and so on. And of course, then you can, for example, add like, you want to add the keyword for camera or hardware or something, you know? And then this tool will find all the posts, all the content on those sites that you were including in the beginning with these keywords. And then you can download them via like Excel, CSV files, even XML, anything you want. You can probably even connect it to a database and just put all the data there. Well, of course, it actually kind of structures your data. Of course, the textual data will not be structured in the beginning, but it can also, like, before downloading the data, you can just say that, I want to see the positive and negative mentions also, and it has these, like, pre-built algorithms for finding the positive and negative mentions based on, well, probably it's also based on a, like, sentiment lexicon or something that's behind it, but it doesn't really work with other languages. You can tweak it kind of manually to work with it, but it takes a lot of time. But with English, it's working quite well. But of course, you know, with these things, you will always have the problem of, like, sarcasm.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything, you know, because, you might find it, like, it's negative, but then it might be positive and your ratio will not be the one that you were looking for. Yeah.
Okay, gotcha. And so how do you deal with the fact that, you know, some comments might be very long, some comments might be very short? Does it matter or not at all?
It doesn't really matter. you know. Well, actually, I was doing a lot of like text mining and analytics with textual data, and you know, one of the easiest things to do is like build a term document matrix where it contains the frequency of the words that's in one of the documents. And for example, one document can be just one line of text or one sentence or these things. And you can just structure it really, really well. And it doesn't matter how long it is, really. Mm. It's just, of course, it will probably take more time to do it, but it doesn't really matter.
Okay, gotcha. And so how long would you say it would take somebody who's never used text analytics before to get into this field and be able to perform their first text analytics?
Well, I would probably say that not too much, because really, if you're interested in it, just go put like text mining in Python mm-hmm. or R. There are a lot of packages that you can just download. It's really easy to use. Once when I started getting into it deeper during the university, I was using R because it had a text mining package, and I was using Python also for web scraping. And actually, once I created a like through a web API of Twitter, I was able to really easily download a lot of posts. Mm-hmm. Like it's like an automated job that it downloaded my posts during the night, and then I was analyzing them during the day. It's really cool. It's really easy. And if you guys out there are really interested in, just take a look at it.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Thanks a lot for sharing those insights into text analytics. Sounds like a very exciting space for people to get into. And like, you're right, a lot of companies will need to do more and more of that, because there's so much unstructured data floating around, and now companies are just getting good at using their structured data, the ones that are using it. And the next frontier for competitiveness is unstructured data, and part of that is text analytics. All right, and so you've done quite a lot of different stuff. You've done text analytics, you've done survival analysis, you're like building some forecasting predictive models. What would you say is your, like, what would you say is the most exciting for you, and also what are you looking forward to learning the most? What is the next type of data science that you can't wait to get your hands on?
Well, probably as I'm working in the energy industry now, I will go deeper into energy forecasting and how we can use all the other features from weather insights. Like, for example, we can use even the precipitation to forecast wind power or these kind of things, you know. Like, I would like to go into details with like what else to use in these mm-hmm. algorithms.
Mm-hmm. Okay, no, that's fair enough, and sounds like a big area that of data science that I didn't even know existed until today. Okay, what I wanted to ask you is, you said that you were doing a thesis on text analytics. That was part of your research, and that's how you got your job. What exactly did you study at university?
Okay, well, that's a funny job, actually. It might take a bit longer to that tell you, but actually I graduated as a business informatics engineer, but it has a kind of a longer story how I got there.
All right, tell us.
Okay, well, actually my professional career started with an internship at banking.
Yep.
You know, where I worked under the supervision of seniors, like business consultants dealing with IT demand management for mm-hmm. business departments. And I get to handle like smaller and larger Excel sheets for like administrative purposes. But, you know, seriously, I remember my first day at work, and my boss gave me an Excel sheet containing the product backlog. And I was just so afraid to touch it. You know, I was during my bachelor's, but like, wow, I have to do something with this. But you know, it was that job that pushed me into analytics. And at that time, I had a conversation with my boss about like staying there full time after my bachelor's. And she said that, yeah, you know, I would like to hire someone with a master's. But, you know, at that time, I didn't think I would want to have one. And the funny part here is that a few days later, mm-hmm. I actually had a dream. It's kind of funny, but I had a dream where I was talking to my supervisor at the university. Like, I was handing in some papers to him when he looked at me and he said that, "Hey, Gabor, I think you made a mistake here because these papers are for bachelors and you need the application for the masters." And, you know, I woke up, I immediately checked the application deadline for masters, and it was a week from that day, and it was my birthday.
Oh, wow.
You know, and I was like, okay, that's a sign. Uh-huh. And actually, I got into one of the best universities in Hungary for masters, and my specialization here was like business intelligence and analytics. And it was mainly about data mining, customer analytics, going deeper into machine learning algorithms. I also remember that I was even building and calculating decision trees and neural networks on paper, you know, for smaller data sets.
That's so cool. So you got into data science because of a dream. That's so awesome.
Yeah, kind of. If nothing, then that was a sign for sure.
Yeah. And but like, why did you choose data science even though for masters, even though you started something else as a bachelor?
Well, actually, I was studying bachelor's as business information systems.
Yeah.
And there I got to study some decision science, business intelligence. And then it sounded really cool. So like to study business intelligence. And that's what the advertisement was saying for this specialization, because it was in English and it said like business intelligence and analytics, and I really wanted to do some analytics jobs also in the future, and it happened, and I'm really glad that I did it because I'm very happy now.
Yeah, that's cool. And what I also wanted to ask you is, how did you said your thesis helped you get your job? How did you use your project, your research that you did at uni, how did you use that to show to employers? Did they accidentally find it themselves, or were you proactively sending it out to people? How did that happen?
No. Actually, I had a friend in university, and her aunt or someone worked at the company at Sykes, and she was saying that it would be nice if you could go to an interview there because they're looking for someone what we are doing at the university also. And my thesis was about it. And then I went there and I was talking about my project. And you know, at that time in Hungary, like they didn't see anyone else before, like who was doing exactly that, what they needed.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so it was very, very easy for you to get it then, if you were the only one in the whole country. Okay.
Yeah. Well, probably not the only one in the country, but like, who were they checking, or I don't know.
Who had they seen before.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a very interesting story. All right, so I got a few rapid-fire questions for you, which I would like to pose. Are you ready for these?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. What's the biggest challenge you've ever had as a data scientist?
Well, it's a hard one. Well, actually, we haven't talked too much about like feature engineering and data wrangling until now, but you know, they're kind of one of the most important and most stressful parts of being a data scientist, when you have to transform and map the data from one format to another, or to create a long data structure from wide data, or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
Or when you have to gather or spread the data based on some specific key value pairs. And to do it well, it can be really stressful and time consuming sometimes, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the biggest challenges that I had actually.
Okay.
I think the biggest challenge of like generally being a data scientist is preparing the data in the right format to be used as an input for the machine learning algorithms. Because, you know, this is what they don't teach too deep in the universities, because there is this, it's just easy to use some pre-made tidy data that they give you in the university, but in real life scenarios it's really not the case. You really have to be careful how to make that input data that you will feed your algorithms with.
And what I also find is it's really hard to find courses or even books that can prepare you for that, because it's hard to come up with a data set that's dirty intentionally, right? Like, it's easy. You commonly find them, you come across them during your work, and you get caught by surprise. But when you want to find one, or when you want to create one yourself, it's not an easy task, you know, for exercise purposes. And I think that's why a lot of courses miss out on that side of things.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, thanks for your answer to that question. And now let's move on to the next one. What is a recent win you can share with us that you've had in your role? Something that you can disclose. I know that, you know, there's certain things that you cannot talk about, but classified things maybe. But let's talk about something that you can share, that you're like something you're proud of that you've achieved or accomplished.
Yeah, okay. So it's back in my previous job when I was doing survival analysis. I actually got a hold of some historical GPS data mm-hmm. of the machines, like coming from sensors and IoT devices. Mm-hmm. And I analyzed that if there is any correlation between the machine's location and the failures or survival time. And it showed that actually there was. So the survival time in one region differed from the survival time in another.
Wow, that's so interesting.
Yeah, and I don't need to say that I got so happy.
Yeah, wow.
Because I had to analyze more. And of course, I had some discussions with the business side, the industry side, and I started extracting and gathering terrain data, like land cover from raster files, and also data from weather stations to get more features to use in the survival analysis. And at the end, I got better results with these new features. So I included them in the solution. So I think it was quite a win, but it took a lot of research.
That's really cool. And so did you ever get to the reason behind why in a certain region the survival was lower?
Yeah. Actually, if you think about the US, you know, like, for example, if you just think about one state, like if there are like Rocky Mountains, of course, your machine will fail more likely when your machine is working on an urban area. Mm-hmm. It's actually, if you think about it, it's really simple, but it shows in the research also.
That's
so
cool.
Really cool.
And so are these machines like constantly stationed in those separate regions, or are these machines traveling across different regions?
During two like failures or services, or between those services, they were kind of in the same type of location. So
it was just generally the case that the machines in this area are more likely to fail than machines in this area, so we need to service them more often.
Yeah.
That's very correct. Interesting. And so nobody knew that before you did that analysis.
Well, not in that solution.
Not
actually.
In an analytical way. That's really cool. Awesome. And it's always fun, I find, that to relate back to the reality of things or the business knowledge, that you find something in the data and then you look at the locations and you're like, oh, that does make sense. It is a more rocky mountains here and it is an urban area here. So like, it's good when the real life confirms what you see in the data, isn't it?
Yeah, that's true.
Awesome. That's a big win. Okay, what is your one most favorite thing about being a data scientist, except for cleaning data, of course?
Yeah, that's the best part. Well, you know, to learn new approaches, to discuss your results with others, mm-hmm. with other professionals. Well, the visualization part is one of my favorites. Like, actually, currently I'm using R ggplot package for visualization, but I've also used Tableau and Power BI, where you can just import any kind of data and you can just create nice plots. And well, another favorite thing is that, you know, when there is always something new to do, to make research about, to try them, to implement them.
Yeah, that's really cool. I like that as well. It's so constantly growing and there's always things that you got to be up to date with to see what's happening, and you can also contribute to the new areas of data science. So that's really cool. Okay, and so from all the different various experience you've seen and types of work, even like you've had work in the office, you're now working remotely and so on, where do you think the field of data science is going, and what should our listeners look into to prepare for the future?
Well, everything. Well, no, actually, this is a good one. Yeah. I've recently been to an AI summit in Vienna.
Yeah.
And there was this inspiring talk of Sepp Hochreiter. Uh-huh. You know him.
Yes, yes.
He's a professor at Johannes Kepler University.
That's so cool that you got to hear him.
Yeah.
He created the LSTMs, yeah, long short term memory for recurrent neural networks in deep learning.
Yeah. And you know, he asked this question like, who of you are still going to human doctors?
Uh-huh.
And everyone raised their hands. And then he asked, like, who is going to AIs? And then, of course, you know, no one put their hands up. And he just concluded that, well, this will change. Don't trust human doctors for diagnostics because machines are better.
Yeah.
And surely he was just making a joke. But if we think about deep learning and image processing, and of course, you had this course on Udemy.
Yeah.
And, you know, machines can just better classify, for example, skin cancer, because it can learn from millions and millions of images, whereas doctors might have just thousands of patients during their practice.
Yes.
So I think this is really interesting to see how far machine learning and AI and data science will go in the near future.
That's so cool that you bring it up, because I totally agree. And there's an app, you can actually download it. It's called Skin Vision, I think. MI Skin, Me Skin, but Skin Vision, I think I've heard of before. And basically, anyway, there's an app you can get on App Store. I'm not sure about the name, but you can get on App Store, I think for iPhone, maybe for Android. And it does exactly that. It, like, you take a photo of something on your skin you're worried about, and it, based on thousands and millions of images that its algorithm, its deep learning algorithm, has been through, it can help understand, or like whatever algorithms in the background, it can help understand if that's skin cancer or not. And they actually tested it against doctors, and it performed as good as several professional skin doctors in the world. And so exactly what you're saying, we're getting to an age where it's going to be AI mostly.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Okay, awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your story and insights. If our listeners would like to get in touch or follow you, or maybe ask questions and see how your career goes further, where's the best place to get in touch with you?
Well, I'm on LinkedIn, so just feel free to send me a message or a request if you have some questions or you want to learn more, or I can learn more from you, then definitely send me a request.
Okay, awesome. We'll definitely share your LinkedIn on the show notes. And I have one final question for you. What is your one favorite book that you'd like to share with our listeners today?
Okay, well, it's really not easy to just say one book, because, yeah, it's hard. But since I'm still really in love with text mining, and I talked a lot about it and how much I really love it and its applications, you know, I would recommend the Introduction to Information Retrieval by Manning. It has topics on how to build web search engines, how they work, also areas on like text classification and clustering, indexing, ranking, and so on. So I can only recommend it for those who are interested in text analysis. It's really a great book. And next to it, you can just create your own stuff in R, Python, or anything, really.
Okay. That's awesome. Well, there we go. Introduction to Information Retrieval by Manning. And if there's a book you'd like to recommend to people who are not interested in text analytics, does anything come to mind?
Yeah. Well, actually, I studied from that book. That was the first book that I got a hold of when I was studying data mining during the university. It's called Introduction to Data Mining. Mm-hmm. I will send you the link.
Okay. Sounds good. So our second book is Introduction to Data Mining. Okay. Well, there we go. Once again, thank you so much, Gabor, for coming on the show and sharing all the insights. Really appreciate you taking the time. And good luck with the remote work, and can't wait to see how your career goes from here.
Thank you very much.
So there you have it. That is Gabor Shoemoshi and his story, and how he's moved through the space of data science. Hope you find that inspiring, and it's hopefully going to give you some ideas of how you can structure your path better. And personally,
What I found the most inspiring was, of course, how Gabor, since our catch-up in Europe, has moved to a remote data science role. So he's working from home now, and that is very in line with his passion of like being free and being able to do what he loves, and at the same time being able to do it from wherever he wants and on his terms. And he's a very talented data scientist, and I'm sure that by being able to control his own time as he desires, he is bringing even more value to the organization that he's working for. And I'm super excited that they have created this environment for him, and I can't wait to hear how his story will progress. I'm very excited to hear how it will progress over the next couple of months or next year or so. So make sure to connect with Gabor on LinkedIn and follow along his career path and see where it takes him. You can find the URL to his LinkedIn at the show notes at www.superdatascience.com/107. There you will also find the transcript for this episode and any other materials that we mentioned during the show. And on that note, thank you so much for being here today. Can't wait to see you back here next time. And until then, happy analyzing.